Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Psychology of Work, Why People Do What They Do, a podcast exploring the science and stories behind high-cohesion, high-performing teams. My name is Dr. Bobbi Wegner. I'm a lecturer at Harvard in organizational psychology and the founder of Groups. In each episode, we dive into the minds of industry experts to uncover what drives team and individual dynamics, tackle real-world challenges together, and share actionable insights to help teams feel and function their best. Thanks so much for joining, and let's get started. Hi, everyone. I'm so excited to be here today. I'm here with Amira Barger, who is an award-winning executive VP at Edelman, where she leads global DEI advisory and communication strategy. With over 20 years of experience, she has worked with major clients such as CVS Health, Pfizer, and CDC in prevention. Amira is also a professor at California State University East Bay, teaching marketing, communication, and change management. We just hit it off, and I just loved all of her wisdom. And then I found out she has a forthcoming book called The Price of Nice, which is coming out in October, which really challenges this idea of niceness in the workplace, you know, and how challenges the notion that niceness in the workplace can really foster genuine connection, arguing instead that it can suppress truth-telling and innovation. Amira advocates embracing this idea of a strategic nerve, which is really the courage to engage in honest, sometimes uncomfortable conversation to build authentic relationship and drive meaningful change. And so this is really why we hit it off. You know, as you know, all of our work is focused on improving connection, cohesion, and performance in the workplace. And I think there's this misnomer that like, when there's a lack of a conflict or something, that's a good sign. When in fact, like actually moving towards a discomfort and talking about the difficult things is a signal of a high performing team. So Amira, in your upcoming book, The Price of Nice, you discuss the hidden costs of niceness at work. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on how this behavior might hinder innovation and really authentic connection within teams? And feel free to add, you know, anything about yourself that I might have missed or anything else you want to add here.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. And truly glad we connected offline and now we're connecting here and get to have this conversation. So thank you. I'm also a mom to a 12-year-old who's going on 30. Sometimes it feels like my little mini Audrey. I have my partner of 20 years, Jonathan, and we have two little fur babies, Bucky and Potato, our two dogs, and I love them dearly. So just some other elements of what keeps me busy these days in addition to all of the writing. But I'm so excited about this book. It has been something that I have been, you know, thinking about for 12 years, this concept, the price of nice, and how it really stifles innovation and really punishes sort of the truth tellers who are disrupting and challenging and daring to have nerve, which is something I talk about in the book too. And, you know, one of the ways that I talk to people about it a lot is using the analogy, metaphor, which word, of a museum.
Okay.
And so people...
Both? I don't know.
Right? Yeah, maybe a little bit of both. But I have found in my career and in my counsel as a trusted advisor to so many leaders that people tend to view the act of setting aside niceness as the problem itself because it disrupts the script, right? We've been taught, so many of us, specifically, I think in a US context, that we need to be nice always, right? To ask nicely or not at all, to qualify our value, to over-explain our needs, to frame every request in self-sacrifice. And I think women especially, and even further, women of color or anyone who is marginalized in a significant way, knows and understands some of those unspoken rules. So when a person asks boldly, whether it's for credit, for funding, for attention, for compensation, for a resource, it's not just a request in many people's minds. The person on the other end views it often as a declaration. And that declaration being, I know my worth. And that can make so many people uncomfortable. And not because what's being asked for or done is a problem itself, but because of what it exposes, right? The status quo depends on too many of us staying small and playing nice. And that discomfort that people feel with those of us who practice nerve, who know our worth, who show up as challengers and disruptors, it gets misdirected as moral critique. And that's, you know, what's really being challenged is power, not protocol. And so the metaphor, here's how I explain it. So it's like a fire alarm going off in a museum, right? So I think of museums in the same way many people do, right? They're safe. They're ornate, they're expensive, they're historic, they're grand. And surely the builders thought of everything. They thought it all through, right? And the space is quiet, it's calm, it's curated and controlled. And there are all these unspoken rules, right? In a museum, you walk slowly. You don't touch. You speak softly in hushed tones. And it looks like order. But behind the scenes, let's say that there's faulty wiring. Freight forward, a slow building fire inside the walls that no one wants to acknowledge or would ever think to acknowledge. You know, some people smell it, some people notice it, but it gets ignored because to acknowledge that there's a problem would be admittance, right? Something is wrong in this pristine, perfect place that was built by builders who know what to do. And we've all been trained to trust the builders, to trust the silence. And so an alarm blares. And what do? Sometimes we panic. We blame the noise. We assume that someone caused a disruption. But the alarm isn't the problem, right? It's a signal. Sometimes the alarm is what we, the disruptors, are viewed as. But really, we, those who are raising our hands saying, is this how it should work? Just because it always has. We're the signal, right? The signal that something has been quietly wrong for a long time. The museum wasn't safe. It was just silent. And that's what happens when someone refuses to shrink. When a person, a woman especially, asserts herself without apology, she's not the danger, but she will be viewed as such. She's the alarm signal, right? Our voice exposes the fragility of that system that only feels stable when we are deferential or nice, right? Our boldness didn't start the fire, but we do in our boldness refuse to pretend that it's not there. And so the alarm in the museum, or us as the alarm, isn't an overreaction, but it is this overdue recognition that something was wrong here all along. And maybe this place wasn't curated, erected, or built in all of the right ways, and certainly not to keep all of us safe.
Wow. I love that. That's so powerful. And it just makes me think that, like, systems seek homeostasis, right? We don't want change, and systems exist. You know, so anytime there's like a change in behavior that's going to challenge this homeostasis, it's going to be viewed as like a risk, right? Because it's like, don't change anything. Because like the unknown, we, you know, humans want, have a need to like control and feel safe by like controlling their environment. So it's like someone speaking up or ringing the bell, so to speak, challenges this homeostasis, which then sort of the outcome is unknown, which freaks people out.
That's right.
You know, and like, what do you do about that? So tell me more about this. Like, you know, so it sounds like part of this is there's like a conflict avoidance thing. People come into this and they don't really want to, you know, have the, you know, they don't want conflict. We want to belong. We want to be part of a group. We want to get along with our teams and with our leaders and our people or people in our life. So we end up being like, you know what? The cost benefit's not really like worth it to me in some way. And I'd rather just sort of pay the price myself. So how do you think about that? And like, what, you how know, does this show up?
You know, I always, what's the word? Sort of recoil physically when people say it costs nothing to be nice. I'm like, but it does. What a travesty of logic. Like, it absolutely does. And I do think that conflict avoidance and the way it shows up can be in the form of niceness, right, is one of the corporate workplaces' favorite coping mechanisms. And it has really great PR, right? It's dressed up as like words you just said, collaborative, flexible, easy to work with. But underneath, it's just avoidance in a power suit, and it can really erode connection. And I think about it with one of my favorite pop culture lenses, The Devil Wears Prada. Have you seen that
movie? Yes. Love it.
So that always comes to mind for me. And I always rewatch that movie every year because I love it. So I adore Meryl Streep. And I particularly adore her as this character, Miranda Priestly, in The Devil Wears Prada. She is this cold, commanding, impeccably dressed editor-in-chief of Runway Magazine. It's this high fashion magazine, and she's this high fashion deity in the space. And she has this new assistant played by Anne Hathaway named Andy, who is an aspiring journalist. And she takes this job as Miranda Priestly's executive assistant to just pay the bills, get her foot in the door with writing, and spends the whole first act of the movie sort of sneering at everything that Runway Magazine stands for. And there's one moment that everyone will remember if you've seen the movie and are a fan. Andy laughs during a meeting where they're talking about a fashion spread. And Miranda doesn't raise her voice. She doesn't even blink, but she delivers this surgical takedown about Andy's blue cerulean sweater, and explains how the fashion industry she mocks chose that exact color years ago, and it trickled down until it landed on the clearance rack where Andy picked it up. And in that moment, Miranda reminds Andy that all of us, no one is actually outside of the system, not even the critics. And here's where it gets interesting regarding conflict avoidance. Andy panics and she runs straight to Nigel, another editor who's played by Stanley Tucci, for help. And cue the makeover montage. She returns the next day to work with sleek bangs, designer boots, and a whole new wardrobe. And suddenly she's accepted. She fits in. She's praised. But she's also playing by rules that she once didn't agree to, that don't align to her sacred values and who she wants to be in the world. But she slowly starts losing pieces of herself in the process of being accepted. And that right there is the danger of conflict avoidance, right? Andy didn't say, hey, that moment in the meeting got to me, let's talk. She didn't ask questions or challenge the culture. She assimilated, because that's what we're taught to do when discomfort shows up. Mirror behavior that's rewarded, avoid the friction, blend in, be agreeable. And it's sort of that social proof in action, right? That psychological survival tactic. We look around and we think or ask ourselves, what's being applauded here? Who is safe? What's off limits? And niceness, more than honesty, more than truth, more than nerve, often becomes that ticket to perceived safety in the workplace. And the problem with that is you suppress your discomfort to avoid rocking the boat, but resentment and actual issues don't disappear. It just goes underground. And underground resentment, that's the stuff that leaks out into some of what we're seeing today and have seen for years: quiet quitting, rage deleting, passive aggression, burnt out teens, talent walking out the door. Niceness, it becomes this unspoken code. Don't challenge the norm. Don't name what's broken. Don't say the hard thing. But every time we avoid necessary conflict, which can be healthy, we treat short-term harmony, which is what we're gaining, right? We gain that short-term harmony, but the cost is the long-term dysfunction that we get to continue to live in, which is not healthy or good for any of us. And so, like Andy, we might wake up one day realizing that we've become fluent in a language and a culture that we were never meant to speak or participate in, one that's not built on truth, but on fear of being seen as too difficult.
Wow, there's just so much there, and you're very obviously a communications person because you just speak so eloquently about everything. But just a few things are really coming to mind. You know, it's just making me think of like groupthink and like why it's safer and, you know, and easier. And it really is rooted in this idea of like we want to belong because we're safer. Right. So like if we're like the outlier, whether we're out on a camping trip, hiking through a canyon and get lost from the group, or at work, we are at risk, you know, and nobody wants to be at risk because that's like vulnerable and bad things can happen if you're at risk, especially if you're in a culture where like you're not allowed to speak up or it's not promoted or, you know, it's not this idea that like from when we look at from a group psychology, team psychology perspective, we know conflict is a healthy sign of a healthy team. It's really about how it's managed. And also that divergent thinking is a sign of a healthy team.
I love it.
Right? When people think outside and are willing to challenge there, it's a signal of high psychological safety. You're willing to take risks without fear of shame or judgment. That's where innovation lives. That's where new ideas live. That's where like boundaries are pushed. But it's hard to do because we all want to belong.
It is. It's a fundamental human need, right? It's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. After food and safety, we want connection, to be included, like you said, to belong. And, you know, we've been conditioned to understand that in order to belong, this is how you're expected to behave. And so many of us have bought into that and we've perpetuated it. And that's why I talk about the antithesis of nice is not mean. It's also not even kind. I talk about it in the book as nerve, that audacity to be a divergent thinker, to be a disruptor, a challenger, to ask more questions, bigger questions of, I know this is how it's always been, but who does this serve? And does it still work for all of us? And being willing to open the door to those conversations, because I think when we do that and we model it, it gives others, I think, the permission they're looking for to also ask more questions and to also move through spaces very differently. Sometimes they need to see it in someone else and to see someone else survive it to engage in the behavior themselves.
100%. And I'm thinking like a lot of the pushback we get from like our work with groups, companies are like, wait, why do I want to rock the system? Like when I think about if I'm a manager, a leader, and you're talking to me, I'm like, okay, Mira, I get it. Like I totally hear you. On the other hand, I do not want to open Pandora's box, because what if I have all these divergent thinkers speaking up, or there's all this conflict? Like, we're here to get some work done. And like, I get everybody has their individual needs, and but how, I can't solve these problems for them. So why even bring it up? Like that sometimes is unspoken.
Yes.
It's actually spoken.
It is more and more. I think people
tell me that.
Yeah.
And then we have to help them understand. I know what I say back, but I'd love to hear kind of what like you say back when you hear that.
Well, for me, it comes down to the stakes. And that's often what I'll go to for people, right? Is the inside and the outside bleed in together. So the personal and the professional. And I think about the stakes and the actual cost of always playing nice. And to me, the stakes are too high. I think how it translates in the workplace oftentimes is what was studied early on in soldiers, the moral injury, right? That originated thinking about how when we betray our values or see values being portrayed, that it really causes something in us, that moral injury, emotionally, psychologically, of what we see. And that silence that we often participate in the form of niceness doesn't come without consequence. It chips away at our internal integrity, our confidence, our sense of self. Niceness then, I think, stops being a strategy and starts becoming a wound, right? It's this mechanism that props up systems that are more invested in harmony than in justice for how people experience the world. And I think the solution to that is the truth telling. That more that people are aware and understand that there are very high stakes and there is cost and there is a name to that cost, whether that name is moral injury or all the other psychological things that happen to us in the workplace, I think that helps people understand the why for the import of addressing this, for being someone who disrupts and tries to do your part to challenge the system. And I think the other thing we have to do is we have to give people the tools, right? We were just talking about that. And even the first time we talked is you have to impart to people the tools. Like you can't just disrupt for disruption's sake. You have to have a plan and a solution and an idea of how you are equipped to move through this space and how you equip others as well. So it always has to come with the coaching and the understanding of getting from point A to point B. I don't want people to practice nerve just for the sake of it because you don't have anything else to do, or just, you know, for funsies, for the plot, as the kids say, do it for the plot. But to do it with purpose. And the purpose is reimagining what we have today for what we know can be tomorrow, and to take planful steps for what are the solutions, what is the new vision, and how do we get towards it and bring people along to be our comrades in getting to that new reimagined world.
I mean, I love it for so many different reasons. Like, I'm a health psychologist by training, so I like look through that lens, who kind of spends most of my time as an organizational psychologist, mm-hmm. right? So I kind of, those are two things. So when I look down those paths, like one, and I always say this, I used to say this to like kids or in like adults, it resonates too. It's like those feelings go somewhere, right? So if somebody's feeling unheard, unseen, whatever, yes. they're it's like little gas bubbles. They get internalized and they're going to come out one way or the other. There's no like disappearing. So you either give them a route out and, that's you know, we great. Function more healthfully, or they're going to bubble up in terms of pain points, right? Pain in different ways, frustration. It's going to get expressed. So how do you actually create a space where you are kind of, you know, have more control over it, really, like to and make it part of the team. It's more functional for everyone.
Yes.
And then when I think about this from like a health psych perspective, it's like, or not a health psych, an organizational psych perspective, it's this idea that like, even if you're the most selfish leader and don't care about people mm-hmm. and you don't even care at all, like about the people side of the business, this is self-serving because you have people sitting on your team that are vulnerable to like low cohesion, disconnection, retention, engagement problems, sub-optimization in terms of performance, all of the things that cost you money. If these people leave, they're going to cost you 0.5 to two times their annual salary. Okay. So if they're not feeling good, they're slowly disconnecting and they're going to leave. Right. And there's only so far dollars go with this. We know this. We're purpose maximizers, not profit maximizers. And so it's like, I would see it almost more as like a team building strategy. Like I could see us, or like even just in how we've taught coming to class or other things, it's like, it gives people a way to understand how to do this and why it's important to create this type of environment where direct communication is part of a high performing team. And it's really a business strategy, not just a kind of like nice to have thing, you know?
Absolutely. And it is, it boggles my mind because there is that cost to it. And it's, to use a health term, right? It's preventative health. It's preventative. Like we need to triage it. And, you know, before we have to get to intervention, like we can be preventative about it. So I think we need to think more in those terms. And I think as more leaders are equipped with the tools and coached through how to move in this way, you know, like I said, modeling it, other people need to see how it's done because it's not easy. I tell people like this is, you're rooting out patterns of behavior and years of conditioning. We all are. Like I didn't get to this place of like nerve over nice overnight. This is years of deep inner work, head and heart work, conversations, coaches, you know, over time. And a lot of that self-reflection of knowing and understanding what corners I need to see around, what are my biases, how have I been conditioned, and what do I need to replace based on some of my own patterns. So it's not easy work, but it is valuable work and it is important. And it is part of just being, I think, a good and a whole human in this world.
Yeah, it's really about the word that comes to mind for me is like integration. It's like, from a health psych lens, we think of like authenticity and like health and wellness as integration between what you're thinking, feeling, saying, and doing. And also like between you, like you and your environment. When you feel like you're really understood and seen, that's where sort of optimization comes in. You know, not when there's friction or barriers, you can't say what you're thinking and feeling. That's where like you start to move down that sort of unwell kind of place. But the way this relates to work is that when you can increase that alignment between the individual and the team or the organization, your retention engagement are going to be so much higher. People are much more connected at a deeper way, and they're much more likely to stay and perform better. So like there's real dollars sort of associated with this. And, you know, I know, you know, like everything I focus on is improving connection, cohesion, knowing it mediates like all outcomes. But communication is the vehicle of connection. It's the thing that brings the people together around. It's like the vehicle in which we like understand and deepen connection with each other. And that is like, it requires honesty and transparency and vulnerability and all of that. And that's not going to happen without like doing the work around it and to understand really what you're talking about is which is our own comfort level in conditioning and what we've learned from growing up.
Yes.
That blocks that. you know? Like, I grew up in a, you know, I'm the youngest of five kids, Irish Catholic family. My closest siblings 9 years older than me.
Oh, wow.
It was very much like pull yourself up by the bootstraps kind
of. Yeah.
You know, I'm very much an outlier as like the emotional psychologist kind of one. Mm-hmm. And I'm like not even that emotional. I mean, I'm emotional, but not like, you know. And so it's like just understanding that about myself.
Yeah.
Knowing my own comfort and but also appreciating that this is like a necessary leadership tool as we're building our own company and building our own team and working with lots of companies, like communications, everything.
Yeah, it is. And similar to you, I grew up in a very Christian evangelical family. I'm the second eldest of eight, right? And so much of that childhood conditioning has shaped my own behavior in the workplace and in the world. And you know, I think represents some of the ways that I was taught early on to sort of play and be nice. Early on, yeah. I think back to those moments and, you know, it's been a part of the journey and part of what I write about in the book too is going back to how I was conditioned and shaped and just working to understand those things so that I can be more purposeful in how I, you know, show up and see things in myself and root out some things that need rooting out now in my adult years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the self-awareness piece is like mission critical here.
It is.
You know, just being able to be like, actually do the work, look at it, and then look at it in the context of whatever environment you're in, whether it's like at home or with your partner, your kids or whatever, or in work, like not all teams communicate the same, right? But we do know that this sort of directness, this sort of, you know, radical candor, whatever else we want to call it, right, is like the sort of best practices in terms of high connection, high cohesion teams, but then contextualizing it around the business goals and like, how do we actually communicate? What does this look like for us? Mm-hmm. And who are the players on the team? If we're all conflict avoiders, it's going to look and feel different and the work's going to be different than if we're all just, you know, really direct people.
Yeah.
That's going to require a different level of like learning and development basically from an organizational perspective.
Absolutely. And I love what you said that we all do have a different role to play. And I think there has to be room and space for that. And that comes with understanding self and having the ability and the curiosity to understand the people around you and to know how to show up in a way that allows for them to fill the space that they are meant to fill and show up as themselves.
100%. Yeah. It's like understanding. There's just so much here. I'm really excited for you. I can't wait to like read your book, but just like the self-awareness piece is really, really important. And I think, you know, workplaces have been like a little antiseptic. We kind of like don't want to get too personal and we don't know how to do this.
We're
and
through.
We're sort of renegotiating this now, kind of coming out of COVID and just for a whole bunch of different reasons, we're trying to figure out what this, you know, workplace looks like, you know, that we're all living in. But understanding both the individual and the team and the organization is really important. And we are, I'm really excited about it. We actually are changing. We're building out like new assessments on our front where we help people. It's almost like a mini personality assessment where you look at things like communication preferences, kind of like your own user manual.
Ooh.
And then having, you know, the map of how this lays out on your team. So you get like a little snapshot of your team kind of personality profile and then how these things intersect. And then inviting teams to basically set norms around this. So like, how do we get how do we get very clear goals, the mission and vision of the team?
Mm-hmm.
What do we want communication to look like? How do we fold in a lot of what you're talking about, which is the communication best practices?
Right.
And how do we contextualize it based on where we all are in our own comfort level with this stuff? Because that's like, we have to meet people where we are in that realm to help them actually do something different.
Nice. I'm excited to learn more about that and that you all are building this. We need those tools.
I love it. So my head's where your head's at and I'm just very excited. But as we get ready to end, Amira, is there one, just let people know where they can find you. Is there anything I didn't ask you that you want to share? And then also like any either books or podcasts or things that you love to read or you know, things that if people are into this, like to read more about?
People can find me on LinkedIn. That's where I'm most active. And I am at Amira Barger on all the other socials. And AmiraBarger.com is coming summer 2025 as we inch towards the book launch in October of this year too. So find me there on LinkedIn and the website eventually and all the socials. Some of my favorite things to listen to are things that really help me get more curious and ask different questions. I was telling someone else the other day, one of my favorite podcasts, and I listen to it almost every day, is The Moth. Have you heard of The Moth?
No, yeah, I love The Moth.
Yes, mm-hmm. I love The Moth. Just the storytelling and that mm-hmm. everyday humans do from all different facets and walks of life just turn on that curiosity button in my brain. And it has just been so transformative, I think, for how I show up and engage with other humans and engage with my work life. Sometimes it's not always about the specific story that someone's telling, but just a way of thinking or a way of seeing something and turning it up on its head. And so I don't think people would think of it in a workplace context as a storytelling platform, but I listen to The Moth all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And it has been really lucrative for learning and moving through the world differently as a leader. So I always encourage people there. And on that, I'm reading a great book right now called The Anti-Ableist Manifesto by Tiffany Yu. Propping up my laptop. That's a really good one. And I love anything by Adam Grant because he roots it all in evidence and has some great case studies that help people see, understand, and sort of know what does this look like in the workplace, because there's so many great cases and studies that you can refer back to of how things played out. So it's not abstract ideas, like it's really practical. You're going to get an idea of how to move differently. So those are some things I would encourage people to look into and think about in their own journey as a leader.
That's all super helpful. And storytelling is everything. It's how we encode information, right? So it like right there in terms of learning, growth, communication, all the things. And yeah, I love Adam Grant. It's just amazing. But thank you so much for spending time with me and with us today. And I will absolutely be cheering for you. Can't wait to read your book and sharing it, you know, widely once it comes out. And we'll talk soon one way or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.